From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a push to relax federal banking restrictions on marijuana-related businesses.
We can't play around with our money as easily because of the limitations of kind of what services we get offered from the banks.
Michigan's Episcopalians will soon have a new leader.
People want to do good, and I think when we in the church present tangible opportunities for folks to do that, people are drawn to us.
Covering the business of sports.
Tax dollars often find their way to the pockets of professional sports teams and their billionaire owners.
And the Korean-American jazz violinist drawn to Spain and its music.
It's all about family and food.
Those stories and much more today for you on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the newly elected bishop for the Episcopal Diocese of Michigan is on a mission to create a welcoming church for all.
We need to have congregations that are not talking about what we believe, but in fact embodying it.
Later in the hour, we talk with the first female LGBT pastor to lead an Episcopal diocese in Michigan and in the U.S. But first, marijuana is a fast-growing industry in our state, but legal dispensaries have a problem. Many banks are wary of handling money involving a substance that's still illegal at the federal level. Yesterday, Governor Whitmer jumped on board a national bipartisan push to help state-licensed marijuana businesses bank their money. The Secure and Fair Enforcement Banking Act would keep the feds from punishing banks that accept money from marijuana businesses. Businesses like The Reef, a medical marijuana dispensary in Detroit. Rush Hassan is head of operations and business development there, and he joins us via Skype. Rush, it seems legal medical marijuana businesses like yours are stuck in a banking limbo. How do you handle money for The Reef?
We find some outside the conventional ways. What we've been working with are some local community banks and credit unions because they're on a smaller scale. They can follow some of the guidance that's been provided by the Department of Justice and the FinCEN, which is a section of the Department of Treasury. And they put in additional regulations that we would have to follow. So some of our cash does make it into these smaller banks, but a lot of the traditional services that normal banks offer, such as line of credit, financial loans, money movement services, such as direct deposit, those are still difficult to find for us. And with those type of things, we're just dealing with the cash flow of our store.
And what does that mean for your business in terms of your ability to grow and also maybe in terms of risk?
The Reef definitely operates on a conservative manner. We put importance on our tax liability, whereas maybe other businesses, they might be able to play around with some of their taxes that have been put aside to take some marketing risk, to take some local risk that they know they could offset later down in the line. Unfortunately for us, we can't play around with our money as easily because of the limitations of kind of what services we get offered from the bank. So as far as growth-wise, we are limited to the growth based on the cash flow of the business. We are limited to not being able to handle maybe bigger marketing risks or just traditional business risks that other businesses might be able to take, we're limited from taking.
Overall, how much of the industry would you say is still cash only?
If I was to put a number on it, I would say probably 60%, between 50 to 60% is probably still majority cash.
And what kind of security risk does that pose for these companies?
Well, that's definitely part of our security plan that we submit to the state. So the state evaluates what type of security plan we have for cash handling, for vendor purchases, for inventory. So I'd say the licensed provisioning centers that are operating with large amounts of cash, they have proper procedures in place to make sure the security there's behind it. So when we do move the cash, we do follow the proper protocols that any other business would.
Sure, sure. So just so everybody's real clear, when medical marijuana businesses like The Reef find a community bank or a credit union that will say, okay, we'll work with you, give us an idea of the limitations.
So some of the additional rules are in place is just validating our actual sales. So being licensed, we are on this statewide monitoring system where a lot of our transactions are being tracked as far as the products that are being sold along with a price value. So any banking would have to have that oversight in place so they can plug in to the same numbers that we'd be reporting to the state. And then some additional measures of how they account for the source of those funds, ongoing compliance checks, ongoing audit checks. Ultimately, what these banks are trying to prove is that these funds coming from the medical marijuana industry aren't being commingled with illegal activities such as drug cartels or any other illegal industry.
How willing have the banks been, particularly as we've seen marijuana become legal in Michigan? Has there been a shift in banks' willingness to work with you?
Absolutely. And then we see a bigger shift coming more and more as we come to this recreational market, along with these two possible bills that are at the federal level, which could really gain a huge momentum and move this industry forward. From the Michigan side, what we've seen is, yes, there have been a large interest in more community banks and credit unions coming into this industry. I was a speaker at the Community Michigan Banking an event last week. A lot of the members of the communities from the banking side that are willing to educate themselves and learn on what it takes to follow and be compliant. So we see the willingness of kind of people coming on board and accepting this as any traditional industry. You know, I come from a corporate world where cannabis really wasn't in my future, and I had the opportunity to join the Reef. But along with that came a lot of the corporate structure and policies that I would have been accustomed to implemented in the Reef. And when banks get that level of trust and see the level of professionalism that we're trying to instill in this very infant market, I think that's how we build the confidence and build these stronger relationships.
You know, Rush, here we've got 19 governors, including Governor Whitmer, 38 attorneys general, including AG Dean and Essel, all saying to Congress, hey, pass the Safe Banking Act or similar legislation. Congress, respect the decisions voters in our state have made to legalize. So what could this do to change the way marijuana businesses operate? What would it mean for you?
Well, I believe a lot of the bigger institutions that are nationwide that have to follow these FDIC rules very closely, this would allow them to open up some type of services that could definitely help us. These smaller community banks and the smaller credit unions, they don't necessarily have the funds available to provide us lines of credit or financial loans, whereas these larger institutions that are handling trillions of dollars, those type of services might be available to us. So I see that this is a potential opportunity for us to maybe grow, kind of betting on ourselves with that growth, because we can go then get some line of credit or a loan and expedite our growth process.
Rush Hassan, head of operations and business development at The Reef, a medical marijuana business in Detroit. Rush, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Half a century ago, hundreds of pairs of piping plovers lived in the Great Lakes. But by the 1980s, they were on the verge of extinction. Only a dozen pairs remained. Slowly but surely, wildlife biologists have helped increase the population, but it's still well below a stable number. And every year, there seems to be a new threat. Interlochen Public Radio's Taylor Wisner reports.
The piping plover is a small, stout, white-gray bird. In the spring, it can be found nesting on the shores of the Great Lakes. Plovers sound like this. That's a recording from Cornell University's Macaulay Library. Once a fixture on the lakes, the birds are now on the federal endangered species list. Vince Cavalieri is the Great Lakes Piping Plover Coordinator and says the birds have a number of threats. He says development encroaches on their habitat, scaring them off, while beachgoers step on their eggs and dogs prey on plover chicks. Plus, he says, increased human presence attracts other predator species.
These are species like crows and gulls and raccoons and things of that nature, which have all kind of risen in number because of human changes to landscape and garbage and different things like that.
Last year, Cavalieri says snowy owls, staying long past their typical winter season, devoured at least six plovers. And this year, the predator may be the lakes themselves, rising to record levels and limiting shoreline where plovers nest. On an overcast spring day, a team of biologists are hiking through the Huron-Manistee National Forest to the Lake Michigan shoreline. Their task is to build nesting habitats for the plovers. They are part of a multi-state effort to more than double the bird's population on the Great Lakes to 150 pairs. Pat Larman is a wildlife biologist with the National Forest Service. He admits it is a long shot. Plovers haven't nested on this part of the shoreline in 10 years, and it's been hard to grow the population elsewhere. But it's worth trying anyway.
When the population is that low at 67, any new recruitment into that population is going to be really, really important. So just individuals matter at this point.
Larman says the birds play a small but important part in keeping the Great Lakes ecosystem balanced. They forage in the sand for tiger beetles, spiders, and wasps, and are prey for larger birds. And biologists' efforts to protect plovers have trickled down, preserving other native species too.
So this section of beach would be absolutely perfect as far as width.
The team has finally found a good spot. It's remote enough that people might not venture there, and the beach is wide enough that the birds have space to search for food. Larman sees cobble in the water nearby, so he heads into the water wearing chunky, knee-high fishing boots. One by one, the team submerges crab scoopers in the water and digs up the pebbles, dumping them into large buckets. Over at the site, Larman chucks the cobble on the sand.
I'm just going to spread this out in here and leave some variation with the density of the cobble and, you know, the little bit of dead vegetation in there. It gives it a nice mosaic.
That was 5 weeks ago. Since then, the team has found a few plovers at the site, but they haven't found any nests. There's still time, but the Great Lakes do keep rising. A couple of nests at other sites have already been washed away. For Stateside, I'm Taylor Wisner.
Coming up, we talk with Ann Arbor native and violinist Maureen Choi about making music after a tragic loss.
It's extremely healing, and many people don't understand or they don't know what the song is about, but they feel something. And I've had many women crying during the song, and they come up to me afterwards and they're like, I don't know what it is about the song, but I was weeping.
This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. One of the most famous songs of the 20th century and one of the most famous voices of the 20th century, Judy Garland. This week marks 50 years since that voice was stilled. University of Michigan medical historian and PBS contributor Dr. Howard Markell is with us with a cautionary tale of Hollywood and the ravages of addiction. Remind us about where and how Judy Garland was found when she died.
Well, she was performing in London, and she was performing in lots of places that last year of her life because she needed the money. She was broke. Mm-hmm. And she was taking a combination of barbiturates and opiates and amphetamines or speed, and she was literally slumped over on the toilet. She was probably constipated from the opiates and was found dead.
And at the time she died, how old was she?
This is the interesting thing, only 49, and if you look at a picture of her, she looks like she's 69. Remember those TV shows mm-hmm. she did? She looks quite old, and you can hear it in her voice. It's a very different voice, say, in the 1960s than the 1940s, for example.
Absolutely. And so what was the official cause of death?
Well, this is the coroner. The Scotland Yard was called, and the coroner said it was a barbiturate overdose, accidental. And the point this doctor was making was that she had been on these meds or these drugs for so long and had such a tolerance for them, like a lot of people did with barbiturate sleeping pills, which is why we don't prescribe them anymore. They take a lot, they feel nothing, and they take more, and they accidentally overdose because they are not falling asleep in an appropriate manner.
You know, when I stop and I think about the way you describe this, it certainly echoes Elvis Presley.
Elvis Presley and many other Hollywood stories, Michael Jackson. And, you know, these people, they're famous and they can get doctors who will do almost anything for them, even if it's ethically wrong or legally wrong. And they become their own doctors, so to speak, which addicts are quite good at doing.
It is such a sad and a far cry from that little girl that America first met in The Wizard of Oz. And you say accidental is not the word that you would use to make a final diagnosis. Why is that?
Well, while I can't surmise if she actually wanted to kill herself that day, addiction is a slow form of suicide. A patient once told me it's suicide for chickens because you never know when that dose is going to take you under and you will die. But she was such a marvelous talent, yeah.
She was. But walk us through that tortured life of substance abuse, because it was starting when she was that little girl making that movie, that made her famous, making The Wizard of Oz even before,
yeah,
right?
She was 17 when she made that movie, but she started working for MGM at the age of 12. She first went on the stage as a two-year-old. Her father and mother were vaudevillians, and she just walked on the stage accidentally and started singing, and everyone applauded. And she, even when she was 10 or 11 or 12, she was heralded as the little girl with the big voice. And so she made a lot of black and white movies for MGM, the Andy Hardy movies, those Mickey Rooney, Judy Garland musicals, which are wonderful.
And those were all after Wizard of Oz.
No, some are after, a few are before. Yeah. And Wizard of Oz originally was going to star Shirley Temple, but 20th Century Fox would not release her. Daryl Zanuck would not release her. I can't imagine that movie with anybody but Judy Garland.
So what kind of pills were studio doctors giving her?
Well, here's the thing. Whether it was studio doctors or they got their own doctors, they were given pep pills to pep up, you know, and then they couldn't sleep. So they were given barbiturates to slow down. Now, imagine doing piecemeal movies. You know, you do scenes and it may be out of order and there's no continuity to it. So this may be the big finale and you have to be Judy Garland. So they would pepper up with amphetamines. And she said, you know, this was MGM and Louis B. Mayer who ordered this. Now, Mickey Rooney, who was in a lot of films with her, said that was not the case. Louis B. Mayer never told us to do that. You know, and Catherine Grayson once said, well, you know, Judy gets drunk a lot and she says some crazy things. But somebody gave her those pills. And by the time she was in her 20s, she was a full-fledged addict.
Weren't they also on to her about weight?
Well, yeah. I mean, so she went to sort of kind of high school at MGM. You know, they're all in between scenes going to school. So, you know, young women and young men have body images or puberty issues and so on. So imagine going to school with Lana Turner or, you know, Clark Gable is walking in the classroom. And so it was amped up and, you know, she wanted the same boys that Lana Turner may have wanted. And there was competition for that. And she had what she called a funny body. She had a short torso and kind of chubby legs. And so she was always struggling with her weight. And she would go up and down the scale, and particularly in her later movies, you know, her last movie for MGM, Summer Stock, which is really a remake of the Mickey Rooney, Judy Garland movies, and neither her nor Gene Kelly were thrilled with the material. But you'll see her really kind of chunky in early scenes, and then that famous Get Happy scene where she's wearing a tuxedo but no pants, she's quite svelte. And she took a few weeks and didn't eat anything. And
probably took a lot of diet pills on top of all the other things.
Yeah, and that could affect your behavior too, by the way. And not eating for a week or two is also not a good thing to do.
What lessons can we learn from? It's interesting. As we speak, I heard this morning a big network report on opioid addiction in the heartland and youngsters growing up basically parentless because the parents are strung out on opioids. What lessons can we take away from Judy Garland's life and her death?
Well, the hopeful one, it's a tragedy because this is such a remarkable talent that is gone. But the hopeful lesson, in my opinion, is that addiction is a disease. It is not a moral failing. And while you do take the first dose or two, once you're hooked, you're an addict. And dealing with these poor souls, and we all know one out of three to one out of four Americans have a substance abuse problem. If we deal with them in legal ways or punitive ways, as opposed to helping them and there are treatments available, then we're lost. And this public health emergency will never get solved. We also have to be careful about what we push, what doctors push and what we write prescriptions for and what the pharmaceutical companies make, because we're all looking for a magic pill. The great Hopkins doctor William Osler said, what separates man from the animals is desire to take medicine. And we're all looking for that magic pill to make us feel up, make us feel down, make us thin, make us happy, whatever. Doesn't exist. There's no free lunch with a pill. You always pay a price.
University of Michigan medical historian and PBS contributor, Dr. Howard Markel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That is violinist Maureen Choi, a Michigander making international waves with her group, the Maureen Choi Quartet. Some call the sound they're creating Spanish chamber jazz, and she is here with us now to talk about the new album out called Thea. Maureen Choi, welcome. So good to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
So tell me, what is chamber jazz, and how did you become interested in this genre?
Well, you know, it's kind of, I don't know if you can call it a genre, but that's how I feel the most comfortable calling what I'm doing. I don't really like boxing ourselves in anything, but if we had to give ourselves a label, I guess that would be the closest thing that encompasses what we're doing. So basically, the music that I compose and the music that I play is a mix of Western classical music, Western classical chamber music concepts in composition and in arranging, and jazz because there's so much freedom and lots of space for improvisation. And Spanish, because I play music of the Spanish diaspora, and I live in Madrid, España now, so.
There's so many interesting colors that you paint your music with, and you're right, boxing, you are not boxed in, not by a long shot. And I know you grew up in Ann Arbor, graduated from Michigan State University, so you were a Spartan, and the Berklee College of Music in Boston. As you say, you are now living and teaching in Spain. What led you to Spain and this interest in the music of the Spanish diaspora?
Well, I've always been interested in Spain in a way because the music has just always drawn me to that place. I mean, I didn't really know anything about Spain, but
the music spoke to your heart.
Yes, because the only word that comes to mind when I describe Spanish music is that it's just handsome. It's just too handsome. It's not only beautiful, it's just handsome.
It's a great word, and I've not heard that before, but boy, that does sum it up. And so tell us how living and teaching there is shaping the kind of music you make.
Well, I actually kind of feel more identified as who I am as a musician, more in Spain than here. It's interesting because living in Spain, I can reflect a lot about my life and how I grew up, because I have that luxury to be able to look at my life from the outside. And I see so many similarities from the Korean culture living in Spain. And
that's interesting. Tell me more about that.
Well, you know, they call Koreans the Latinos of Asia because we're all very fiery, and Spaniards are extremely fiery like Koreans. You know, it's all about family and food. The importance of food, I mean, is huge in the Korean culture and in the Spanish culture. You know, no matter how much you eat, your mom is always asking, do you want more? Are you sure you had enough? And it's that way in Spain all the time. So I feel very comfortable in that regard.
The pleasures of life, food, music, it all fits.
Yeah,
it all fits. And tell me more about how your Korean heritage factors into your music.
My Korean heritage factors into my music just because Koreans have a lot of respect for classical music, Western classical music. And my mom, she sang soprano, and my father played Spanish guitar. And so my mom studied in Vienna, and my parents were just lovers of music, and music was on 24/7. So, and all the, my favorite violin repertoire, all the concertos that I love to play, they all had a hint of the Spanish sound. Those are my favorite to play. So, and it also just fits my personality. I'm not so much of a Mozart player.
You could do it. You could do it.
Yep.
But your heart calls you elsewhere. Well, let's take a listen to one of your tracks. Tell us about Dear Paco.
Okay, well, Dear Paco is I'm paying tribute to the great Paco de Lucía. He's one of the most important and the greatest guitarists that ever came out of Spain. He died 4 or 5 years ago, I believe. And the influence that he had in the flamenco world and the jazz world is tremendous. And so I took one of his tunes from the 80s, I believe, and I transcribed all of his playing and I put it on my violin. So I was trying to grab everything that I could from the guitar, flamenco guitar, and mix that in with all my classical training and all the technique that I know, and to have it sound, you know, like the flamenco guitar but on the violin. So that's our tribute to the great Paco de Lucía.
Track from the new album from the Maureen Joy Quartet called Thea. What does that title mean?
Well, Thea in Greek mythology is a titaness, the mother of Selene, the moon goddess, Helios, the sun god, and Eos, goddess of the dawn. And in astronomy, Thea is a planet that collided and melted into the early Earth 4.5 billion years ago, and the cloud of debris is what formed the moon. So Thea, to me, well, I had a pretty rough 2018, so this album is a representation of chaos and loss, but I came out stronger with more colors and different perspectives at the end. So Thea is kind of, and the first track, Phoenix Borealis, kind of represents that also. I mean, the bass solo has crazy sounds.
It does.
And, yeah, with effects.
It does.
And then I come in there kind of flying, you know, with harmonics, improvising in harmonics for a while. And so it kind of paints that picture of dark and light.
Can you share a little of what happened in that rough year?
Yeah, I lost my first child.
So music was a real therapy for you.
Yeah, I actually composed September the 1st for my first child.
Okay.
The melody just kind of poured out of me in the tragedy and the sadness. It's a very simple song, but it's extremely beautiful because it's so sad. And the melody is very simple and but melodic. It's very touching. And during our live concerts, we have people singing with us at the end, so everyone gets to be involved.
How did that process of writing this and then as you stand in front of a crowd and have them share in this moment in your life through this song, is that healing?
It's extremely healing, and many people don't understand or they don't know what the song is about, but they feel something. And I've had many women crying during the song, and they come up to me afterwards and they're like, I don't know what it is about this song, but I was weeping. And then there are some times when I do share, well, I wrote this song to heal the loss. And then I have those moments where I can't connect with some fans on a very personal level because, you know, you just start sharing and you build these real human connections. And so September the 1st is a very emotionally heavy piece, but every time I play it, I do feel a little lighter.
I know you've played all around the world. You're on your North American tour right now with some dates this week in the Great Lakes, which we'll have more on in a moment. Just wondering, our audiences, let's say if you're playing on a stage in Beijing, are they different than playing on a stage in Ann Arbor?
Well, I'll let you know because I'm going to Asia for a month in September.
How about in Spain?
In Spain, Well, in Spain, they're rowdy, and I love that. Well, it depends on where in Spain, because the north is a little bit colder. But, you know, basically the south and Madrid, I mean, they're always screaming and crying and dancing, so.
And I know this is a new album out, but do you have your eye on the next project?
Yes. So we've made arrangements of Rimsky-Korsakov's Capriccio Español. And that kind of gave us the idea for the next album, which is going to be arrangements of Manuel de Falla. And so we're going to take a bunch of his pieces and arrange it in the style of Maureen Choi Quartet.
Very, very fun. Well, the Maureen Choi Quartet will be performing all around Michigan this week, this Wednesday the 19th at Cliff Bells in Detroit, Saturday at the Summer Solstice Jazz Festival in East Lansing, and then Sunday at the Carytown Concert House in Ann Arbor, back before a hometown crowd. And you can get all the details about the tour and this new album, Thea, by going to MaureenChoi.com. Such a pleasure, and thank you so much for spending time with us on Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. After the break, we'll talk with a reporter who goes beyond the wins and losses of a pro sports team to reveal just how the industry of sport affects us all. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Bill Shea's been covering the business of sports in Detroit as a reporter for many years with Crane's Detroit Business. Well, now he is moving to the sports site, The Athletic, not to cover strikes and hits and scores and wins, but to cover sports business, media, and law for the Midwest. Why is it important to cover not just a team's wins and losses or the players, but what's happening in the front office and the industry of sports? Bill Shea's with us now. Welcome, Bill.
Thanks for having me.
There are people listening to us talk right now who kind of just shrug, don't particularly care about wins and losses in sports, let alone any of the glitz and glam of professional sports teams and the athletes. Should people be paying attention to the industry, the business of sports?
Yeah, I think they should, especially because in tax dollars often find their way to the pockets of professional sports teams and their billionaire owners. And I think it's good for people to pay attention to, you know, what's going on around them in their communities. And you never know how you're going to be affected. You know, and sports are often, you know, petri dishes for new technologies and things like that, that extend eventually to other aspects of people's lives. You know, paperless ticketing for events. Well, I think we're going to see that sort of technology expand into other things in your everyday life, where you're not necessarily a fan of any team or stick and ball sports or anything, but things that were born out of the sports industry will eventually work their way into everybody's lives.
So explain this new direction that you're going to be doing for The Athletic.
Well, it's something they launched on Monday. They've been around for a few years, and you know, they're a subscription-based sports site with the intention of providing sort of in-depth, you know, explanatory, unique journalism that you really can't get from newspapers and other sites or your ESPNs. And on Monday, they rolled out a new media unit that's going to cover the business of sports, sports media, and sports law.
All of those elements that you mentioned, media and business and all kinds of elements, were wrapped up in a story that you broke earlier this year with Cranes about the lack of progress that the Ilitch family has made in building up that District Detroit, the one they promised to rehab with tax incentives and build new life around the new Little Caesars Arena. Bill, is that a story that would have gone missed by other media outlets, or were you able to get to it more quickly because you cover the industry in this way?
Well, I definitely like to think we got to it more quickly. There's other, you know, other people have written variations of that, but because myself and others at Cranes were so deeply vested in that story for a long time and covering the incremental pieces of that, we were able to put together the journalism that I think really told the story of what happened, what hasn't happened, and why it matters.
And I'm wondering what you think of the work surrounding District Detroit, because a lot was promised by a very, very wealthy, prominent family, and they still have not built the apartments and the storefronts and all the things they said would come with the Little Caesars Arena. Do you think stories like yours put pressure on them to actually complete the work they promised?
Well, I certainly hope so. Accountability is a big part of why I do what I do, holding the powerful and the wealthy accountable, especially, when they ask for and get public money. Well, then there's the expectation of, hey, you said you would do this thing. If not in the letter of the law, you at least showed the public all of these pictures, and in return for this money and support and continued support, you would build all these apartments and offices and parks and restaurants and bars, or cause other people to build them. And it really hasn't happened yet.
No, instead, we've got parking lots, lots of parking lots.
Parking lots and garages. That's certainly, those promises are kept. But yeah, that's, I hope what we had done and what some other media outlets have done have sort of, if not inspired the Ilitches to uphold their promises, to inspire those who can keep them accountable to those things, especially when they come asking for more money from the public in the future, that they can say, hey, you didn't deliver on this, and here's these stories outlining why, demand a better deal for the public with more accountability built into it.
And speaking of asking for money from the public, tax incentives for big sports facilities have gotten a lot of public scrutiny in this country in recent years, because there does not appear to be the return on investment that the benefactors claim, the jobs and the boost to the local economy. Is there still room to argue in favor of granting hundreds of millions of dollars in tax dollars to families like the Ilitches for sports facilities?
I think it depends entirely on what you believe the role of taxes in government are, and sort of where you stand on the ideological spectrum with that sort of thing. I think almost all of these projects overpromise. Are like in the case of the District Detroit and Little Caesars Arena, there are more full-time permanent jobs created. At what cost, though, to the public is the question. And I think it's, sports team owners who come hat in hand saying, they're going to create all these jobs, or they have to move the team unless they get a new stadium the public pays for these billionaires. I think it's very good that there's more scrutiny on that. There are now decades of academic literature that say, if you're looking for these as a winning lottery ticket, it really doesn't happen. I think there's other ways they could probably sell these. But the one thing is, I've yet to see a compelling case or argument by a billionaire why they need public money. I get why they ask for it, because politicians are willing to give it to them. Nobody has ever shown me an actual need of like, hey, I need $500 million from the taxpayers.
Bill, as you know very well, sports are big business in Detroit, and we have big names attached to major franchises. We have the Ilitches with the Tigers and the Red Wings. You got the Ford family with the Lions. Dan Gilbert owns the Cleveland Cavaliers, but has sniffed around investing in perhaps a professional soccer team in Detroit. Is this normal in America's big cities to have the big power players in a city's financial and business sectors intersect with the local sports industry?
I think in some places it is. Detroit, it's I think an interesting set of circumstances that the small number of elite, ultra wealthy people who hold power, especially in the downtown, the central business district, happen to be sports team owners. As automotive receded in this city and was replaced, not completely, but in segments by other industries such as online mortgages, those folks as part of their portfolio had sports teams. I think you can find it in other cities, but Detroit, it is very, a prevalent case where your most elite wealthy individuals happen to own all four sports teams, and maybe one day a fifth.
Bill, as you kind of dive into this work you're going to be doing at The Athletic, do you see opportunities to expand coverage to other complex social issues surrounding sports, such as Title IX in collegiate sports, or drug use issues like that?
Absolutely, because all of those things are part of the business of sports. They're interwoven in the labor agreements with the leagues and at the collegiate level. And my new colleagues are very interested. You know, and I've done some of that in the past. You know, the politics and social issues and how they, you know, affect. You know, we saw a couple of years ago when the players kneeling in the NFL and the shockwaves that sent through through pro sports and how teams and leagues and players handle these things, you know, and you know, there's a segment of the public saying, you know, stick to sports. I you know, we want an escape from that, but you can never really escape because sports are American culture. It's the mirror that we hold up and see. We reflect that, and they've always been like that. So I'm very excited to tell those or help tell those stories on, you know, you know, gender and other diversity within hiring and coaching and front offices. And, you know, there's just an endless number of stories to tell out there.
Bill Shea, leaving Crain's Detroit Business after 13 years. He'll be reporting on sports, business, media, law, and more for The Athletic. Thanks for spending time with us, Bill.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
The 16,000 members of the Episcopal Diocese of Michigan are getting a new leader, elected earlier this month. And by next February, she will be invested as the 11th bishop of the diocese that is older than the state of Michigan by 1 year. Here with us now is the Reverend Dr. Bonnie Perry, the newly elected bishop for the Episcopal Diocese of Michigan. We want to welcome a history maker. This diocese dates back to 1836. You are the first woman and first member of the LGBT community to become its bishop. Indeed, the first gay woman priest to lead an Episcopal diocese in this country. What does this mean to you and to your church?
Oh, wow. Thank you so much for the welcome.
Yes.
I think what it means is the Diocese of Michigan has long been a leader in issues of justice and inclusion. And my predecessor, Bishop Wendell Gibbs, has been an amazing supporter and proponent of LGBT inclusion and supporter of women and just working for all issues of justice. His predecessor, Stuart Woods, was the same way, and his predecessor, Coleman McGee, was also someone who supported and was on the forefront of all of these issues. So I think, Cynthia, I am blessed by this diocese's DNA for inclusion and justice.
You're going to be the spiritual leader of 95 congregations in Southeast Michigan. What's on your agenda for the church here?
Wow. Well, first, I don't know what I don't know. So I really am going to be spending a great deal of time listening to the wisdom of the people who have long served these congregations and find out what their hopes are, what they're yearning and longing to do, and then create our vision as we live out gospel values going forward. But all of that has to happen in conjunction
from Michigan
with
Radio.
The folks who are already in Michigan, not someone who's just come over the border from Chicago.
And the Episcopal Diocese of Michigan, like so many other denominations, has seen membership shrinking. Statistics show the number of baptized members dropped 46% from 2000 up till now. Why do you think that that's happening, not just in the Episcopal Church, but others?
Yeah, it really is. It's certainly a concern. And what I know is that here at All Saints, the congregation that I have served for the last 26 years, we started as a tiny place that was on the verge of closing when I came, and we're now one of the largest congregations in the diocese. Our average age is 38. We have tons of families with lots of kids, about a third LGBTQ. And what I know is that when congregations really focus on living out the gospel and stop worrying about whether or not we're going to survive, because Jesus didn't call us to set up an institution. It's a movement. And it's a movement to embody God's love for people. And so how we're reaching out to people and living out the values of inclusion and justice and equity, I think that makes a huge difference. And we've certainly seen that here at All Saints. And that is that's an experience that I will bring with me to our congregations in Michigan.
Because certainly it seems important that churches and denominations figure out how to reach young people who often don't feel organized religion is meaningful in their lives.
Yeah, absolutely. And good on them, right? We need to have congregations that are not talking about what we believe, but in fact embodying it. And I have found that when we do embody it, young people come. We started a community kitchen and food pantry here. And first day in Ash Wednesday 1992, we gave away 2 bags of food to the 2 people who came. It's now a not-for-profit that is very closely held by our congregation. We see 250 of our neighbors every Tuesday night for groceries and another 125 of our neighbors for family-style sit-down meal and groceries. On the average, we have 50 or 60 volunteers every week making it happen. About half are from the congregation, half are from folks in the neighborhood who want to do good. And the average volunteer, again, that age is about 35 or so. Hmm. All people, young and old, want to be involved in something bigger than ourselves, something that makes a difference. People want to do good. And I think when we in the church present tangible opportunities for folks to do that, people are drawn to us.
Reverend Perry, there are some more conservative members of the church who object to your appointment as their bishop because you are a gay woman. Some even talk of perhaps leaving the church. Talk to them.
Cynthia, I'm the daughter of a Marine Lieutenant Colonel. My roots are conservative. I have spent much of my ministry bridging those chasms, bringing people together from different theological perspectives. And I know what it's like to be left out, to be excluded for theological beliefs. And I have vowed that I will never do that to anyone who has a different theological perspective than I do. So I plan on lots of conversation, lots of prayer. If those congregations desire something that is called a delegated Episcopal pastoral oversight, and so another bishop comes in on a temporary basis to care for them, to make sure those faithful parishioners receive sacraments, then we'll do that. Because you never create community by excluding people. That's a false choice, and I will do my best not to exclude anyone.
Let's say you and I are talking in 5, 10 years. What do you hope you'll be able to say about what the Episcopal Diocese of Michigan will look like and is doing?
Yeah, well, I'm not terribly good at telling fortunes. And I am convinced that as we live out Jesus' call to love people, to care for people, to make tangible changes for folks who are facing injustices, then I think people then are drawn to that, just as people were in the first century when Christ's apostles first went out and preached about him. And so I think we're going to be growing. I think we're going to be a force for good to be reckoned with. And I'm super excited about doing that.
The Reverend Dr. Bonnie Perry, the newly elected bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Michigan. She will be invested next February. Thank you so much for speaking with us on Stateside, and we look forward to further conversations.
Oh, Cynthia, thank you. I really appreciate being asked. You have a blessed day.
To Tomorrow on Stateside, we talk with the creators of Dearborn Girl, a new podcast sharing the stories and struggles of Arab and Muslim women in Dearborn. And we'll talk with Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin about the potential to expand Michigan's defense industry and get her thoughts on President Trump's job performance. That's tomorrow on Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.